The English is 25-8-3. Next week, Paul goes, according to plan, there will be no class next week. I am planning to go to Israel Sunday night. And we'll be back, if all goes as is planned, in New York on Friday morning. So my hope is to get to Israel in the time. That's why every sentence I say is filled with caveats.
Into the strike this week.
What happened yesterday, but late yesterday, the Histadrut called off the strike. They didn't say that it wouldn't be next week, but they called it off for this week. So I was pretty sure it wasn't going to happen this whole trip. But yesterday, late yesterday, they called off the strike. So it looks like it's going to happen. So it's a short trip. I'm hoping to get there in time to be in Jerusalem for Purim. That's the real challenge, because remember, Purim happens in Jerusalem a day later than everywhere else.
Why?
Because it is Shushan Purim. Shushan Purim. According to the Halacha, all cities that were walled in the time of Joshua ben Nun celebrate a day later, because if you remember in the Megillah, you'll see again in the Megillah, that in Shushan Abira, the fighting went on a day later, and therefore the celebration was one day after the celebration of Purim in all the provinces. To remember that, all cities that were walled, as Shushan was, but walled during the time of Joshua. The question is, and the Talmud asks, why the time of Joshua? You would think it would be the time of Mordechai and Esther, everything that was walled at that time. And the answer to that is, during the time of Mordechai and Esther, you remember the very beginning of the Megillah, when Mordechai is introduced, he was among the exiles from Jerusalem. And during that time, Jerusalem was in ruins. And therefore, it would not be fitting dignity to recall a walled city while Jerusalem was in ruins. So we don't even think about that. Rather, we go back to the conquest of the land and the cities that were walled at that time, because that should be the point of reference. So the Gemara then asks, well, if that's true, how about Shushan? In Shushan Abirah, if Jews live in the city of Shushan, that was not walled during the time of Joshua. Should they observe it on the 14th day or the 15th day? My answer is that they should observe it also on the 15th day, like Yerushalayim, because after all, the nest did occur there. But every place else, it goes according to Joshua. So the one exception to the rule is the city of Shushan itself. Anyway, that's a long way of saying that if I leave, I'm leaving New York, my flight is 11:50 p.m. Sunday night. By then, Purim will long be over for us. I get to Israel 5:15 p.m. on Monday, and I get to Yerushalayim, let's say, by 7. The Purim Seudas in the old city will still be going on, because the Hasidim keep celebrating into the night. So Ezra said to me, he says, well, you just have to go and visit, go see some of our friends, the Hasidim, because they'll probably be going by the time you get here.
My wife,
that should be good. By then, the Hasidim should be all prone.
very quiet.
Exactly. About Adalayana, you should drink enough on Purim till you don't know the difference between blessed is Mordechai and Karkasa the same. So Gemara says, well, what happened was one year the rabbi got so drunk, he saw his friend and he killed him. He was totally drunk, he killed his friend. After which the other rabbi who was there prayed for him, and he came back to life. So it wasn't so bad. Comes the next year, the three rabbis are together again. The first rabbi says to him, you better not do this. So he says, well, what's wrong? He says, well, he says, there's nothing wrong with that. You saw, I killed you last year, you came back to life. He says, you can't depend upon miracles twice. So a little bit of Purim humor. All Chvod Purim. Okay. Our service, by the way, keep in mind, Saturday night, 7 o'clock here, starting with Mari. I'm going to start after everything so I can set up a mic. And then in the morning at 8:45 over at the Lycée Français, which a good number of people have been to, and they say it's really nice over there. Have you been there?
No.
Yeah, people tell me it's really nice.
One from the range.
Arthur? Arthur, Bonnie?
No, the woman from the
Lycée
Français.
Oh, Phil,
Catherine.
She says it's quite lovely.
Yeah,
Catherine.
Right, well, thanks to them, we're able to be there. So we're able to arrange that. So tomorrow night I'm going to go over there and I'll see it. Okay, we're in 25A3. And just to recapitulate where we ended off, remember we were reading about the deaths of rabbis, and most specifically we had read about the death of Rav Huna, who was a great Babylonian rabbi, and there was some thought of placing a Torah scroll on his casket, on his bier. And Rav Chista then reacted and said, you know, how could you do that? Don't you remember that Rav Huna wouldn't even allow a Torah scroll to be placed on his bed, let alone on his bier? So you can't do that. No, that was fine. And then we read about him. He was in this bier in the house somewhere on the top floor of the house, and they couldn't get it out the door. So they suggested moving him from one casket to another. And then the Gemara said, you can't move somebody from one casket to another. It's not the fich vodam. It's not a proper dignity. And then it says, well, how about we'll take him up on the roof and we'll take some ropes and let him go down that way. They said, that's no way to treat a rabbi, in effect. So finally they decided the only way to do it was that they pushed the door down. That worked. But I was apparently full of a proper respect for the rabbi. Rabbis like to push toward guys now. Okay, so that was the story of Rav Hamanuna, and that brings us to where we are in 25A3. Now, they've taken the casket out, and you can see the process here. The process is that they take the casket out, and then they begin the eulogies. And what we're going to be looking at now, nearly exclusively, not entirely so, but nearly exclusively, is a good section in the Gemara now about eulogies. Very interesting Gemara, the likes of which we haven't seen much of. We, for whatever reason, are mostly reading all of our years. We're reading a lot of halacha. And here you have a full agadic section that's coming up now in the Gemara, and you see the sense of it is quite different. Okay, Patach Alei Rabbi Abba. Rabbi Abba began the eulogy for Rav Huna. Ra'ui haya Rabbeinu shetishre alav shechina. Our rabbi was so worthy that the divine presence should rest upon him. Ella shebavel garmale. But the problem was that he lived in Babylonia. Now, Rabbi Abba was probably an Israeli, all right? And so what he is saying, the divine presence should have rested upon him. That is to say, he was so holy, he was really a prophet, but he never prophesied. And why did he never prophesy? Because he was a Babylonian. Babylonians can't prophesy. Babylonians can't prophesy. Only those who live in the land of Israel have the power of prophecy. This is what he says. Nitiv Rab Nachman bar Rav Chisda. Rab Nachman bar Chisda then says, no, it's not true. Ba'amil Rab Nachman bar Chisda. And there are those who say, it is Rav Chanan bar Chisda, not Rab Nachman bar Chisda. He quotes, Hayo haya devar Hashem el Yechezkel ben Buzi HaKohen be'eretz Kastin. Much of the book of Ezekiel takes place in Babylonia. And Ezekiel is prophesying in Babylonia. When he prophesies about the Valley of the Dry Bones, he's not in the Valley of the Dry Bones, he's about in Babylonia, speaking about the return. Okay? So here, Rabbi Abba has just said that you can only prophesy in the land of Israel. Now he's coming through like he's an Israeli who just has an axe to grind. Because Rav Chisda gives a correct quote. Tafach le avu habasandale. His father, now this is one of the sons of Rav Chisda saying this. He had two sons, this Rav Chanan and Rav Nachman. Both of them are Bar Chisda. So it's one of them, but anyway, it's one of his sons. So here you see what the father does. Tafach le avuha besandale. It's clear to me what this means, even though the English sort of misleads you. Tafach le avuha besandale means his father gave him a little bit of a tap with his sandal. In other words, his father, he doesn't want to, they're in a crowd of people, so he doesn't want to say anything very publicly, but he wants to reprimand his son, so he takes his sandal and kicks him a little bit with it. Okay, that's the beginning of it. And then it's Amale, the father then of Chisda says to his son, Lav aminalach lo titrot alma, haven't I told you not to bother people? In other words, this kind of analysis is so dumb. You know, your point is just not the kind of point that you should say in learned company. So haven't I told you to be more discreet in knowing what to say and when to say it? Okay? As he now explains, my haya, right? It says, hayo haya devar Hashem el Yechezkel. It's a double verb, the infinitive form of the verb, hayo haya, which we normally translate as a strong form of the verb, but the rabbis hardly ever do that. If it's two forms, hayo and haya, there must be some reason for it. My haya, what is the force of the haya part of this? Right? Shahaya kvar. He already had begun prophesying before this. So in other words, hayo haya, that he now is a prophet in the land of the Chaldeans, meaning in Babylonia. Yeah, that's true. He was a prophet there. But he started his prophecy in the land of Israel. Right? Stupid kid. Don't you remember that? I mean, you're bothering these sages without having that obvious insight that any simple sage would know. Right? So here, the point that they're getting back to now, and Rav Chisda is a Babylonian himself. Rabbi Abba is not. Rabbi Abba is an Israeli. Rav Chisda is a Babylonian. So Rav Chisda's point again is he supports the idea that prophecy is only in the land of Israel. You must become a prophet. The Shekhinah Shora Alecha, it only comes upon you in the land of Israel. I happen to believe that it's absolutely true. And I agree with that point of view. I think that you're not a prophet. Not a prophet. The prophets, I mean, he was an interesting guy, but I don't think I would call him a prophet. Okay. Well, the question is whether it's still possible, and I think that to the extent that there's any extraordinary transcendental possibility, it's only in the land of Israel.
Or in Washington, D.C.
Or in Washington, D.C., you think so?
He is connected.
Yeah. Land of Israel. Only in Israel. So this now supports Rabbi Abba's initial statement, which is that prophecy, that Rav Huna would have been a prophet if but for the fact that he was a Babylonian.
What about Moses? Moses was not in Israel, was he?
That's a good point. That's mentioned elsewhere in the Gemara. And the answer to that is that there was no other option. That was before the people went into the land of Israel. So Moses is, in fact, an exception to the rule, you're right. And that's because of circumstances.
That's more than the leadership.
Moses what?
And the political leadership of the people. Correct. Usually a Navi doesn't have the political leadership.
Perfect. But Moses was a unique prophet in a unique circumstance. So Moses is the exception. Once the people enter the land of Israel, though, then there's no other option. It's the land of Israel, the only place where the action is. Okay?
How do the rabbis understand the word we said, prophecy? In other words, the difference between that and somebody who, according to tradition, although that was probably in the book, Shimon Bar Yochai, who received revelation, what's the distinction between one and...
In a very simple way, there is a requirement of telling the future, and corroborating the tale of the future. That is one of the standards which the Gemara uses. The Gemara uses that. Okay? And it could be that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai would fit the bill, at least according to what these criteria, because he did live in the land of Israel. He wasn't Israeli. And to use the general sense of the Shekhinah would fall upon him, would be on him. Well, that's not exactly the same as the biblical prophets, I would say. It's not exactly that. But it's a pretty strong statement.
Does this all identify a cutoff chronologically where after there was no more prophecy or in theory?
I think the answer to that is yes, but I don't know where. Because I've never read it in the Gemara to my recollection. You read it, you read statements. Meir said it before. After the destruction of the temple, prophecy has departed from Israel. It's taken away. So you do have that. But even though you have that, you have a statement like this. I mean, yes, you have that. But I don't think that it means that you couldn't have the other possibility also, even though you have that. You would say something like, well, it wasn't the same, it was different, but still there was something powerful, transcendental, unusual, and otherworldly that was possible. Okay? Okay, good. Yes, sir.
Directly related, but if you're talking about Moshe was a Navi outside of Eretz Yisrael.
Mm-hmm.
God also did not reside in Eretz Yisrael at that time. He encountered Moshe in Har Sinai and in Midian, and earlier he encounters Adam and Eve in Gan Eden. So I understand the covenant between God and Abraham. On what basis did he choose Canaan, Eretz Israel, as the place where, not just where the Jewish people were resided, but where God himself was?
Mm-hmm. That is too big a question to respond to. Okay. It's a good question. It's too big a question to respond to, if you'll allow me. Okay? Let's go on. Okay, now, in fact, he is buried, Rav Huna, in the land of Israel. And it's interesting to see, you'll see several of the Babylonian rabbis are brought to the land of Israel. And you can, to this day, visit their graves. Most of them are in Tiberias. There's a whole section of the cemetery in Tiberia where you have the rabbis of the Talmud. Now, any proof of any of that? It's just too long a period. You could never have any proof of it. But you do have that in Tiberias. You have rabbis in the Talmud you have in your neighborhood, in Bet Sha'arim. The rabbis of the Talmud are buried in Bet Sha'arim. We know that. And we know where Bet Sha'arim is. You can go there and you'll see a story that will reflect, I'm sure, Bet Sha'arim. We're going to read very shortly. So there was a tremendous attraction in those days, as throughout Jewish history, to being buried in the land of Israel. Probably for all kinds of plain reasons that I would call today Zionist reasons, but also there is a theological reason, which you were at the breakfast last week, our Chevra Kedisha breakfast. We mentioned the Chevra Kedisha breakfast that when you prepare a coffin, one of the things after you dress the deceased and you place the deceased in the coffin, one of the things, you were there. You take dirt from the land of Israel and you put it in a coffin. You scatter it in the coffin. So why do you do that for? The reason is Admat Yisrael Mechaperet. The land of Israel has the power to provide atonement. And that is the unique power of the land of Israel, and that is why a Jew buried, no matter where the Jew is buried, tries to be buried with the land of Israel in the coffin. And that's one of the reasons I say, reason number one was what I would consider in the most general way the Zionist type reasons of the special nature of the land of Israel. But number two is the atoning power of the land itself as understood in the Jewish tradition. So you had many of the rabbis who have come from Babylonia and wish to be buried in the land of Israel. Certainly there are rabbis buried in Babylonia, and that's what I was hoping if this whole Iraq thing would have gone the way it was supposed to. If you remember, about 1 week after Bush announced victory, UJA was already talking to the tour guides. And I'm sure they were planning this year's mission was going to go to Iraq. Well, it didn't exactly happen that way. So that's at least put off a little bit. And my Iraqi friends tell me, well, there are very famous graves in Iraq, of both the rabbis and, of course, of people from the Bible. Jonah is buried in Iraq, and I think Ezekiel was buried in Iraq. And others, I don't really know that piece of history. I was hoping to go on that trip. We'll have to wait till we figure that one out. But that was in Iraq. The desire always was to be buried in the land of Israel. That was the desire. And even at the in the later periods of the Amoraim, of the later Amoraim, I remember one trip that I took a few years ago. I specifically went, and it's not far outside of Tzfat. In the hills outside of Tzfat are the graves of Rava and Abaya. You know, we always read Rava and Abaya. They are partners in argument all the time, and they're disputing with one another. There are two graves, one for Rav and one for Abaya, right outside of Tzfat. So I actually have a picture of myself sitting on the Rav's grave, which is in way inside, all black in there, it's all very dark. But Ezra took a picture of me. And those graves are probably all likely a much later idea that these people were buried there. Graves in Tiberias, these are traditions that go way back. The Bet Sha'arim graves go way, 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 way back.
Tiberias is modern
compared to Bet Sha'arim, it is. And then compared to Tiberias, where I was, the graves of Rav and Abaya, the identification of those particular places are modern in comparison to that. I think they probably...
It's interesting that the Mimuna they do around Tzfat in the Mimuna. You know, the Sephardim big celebration,
Well, that's a little bit different. I'll tell you what the difference is. That is, those are the graves of Tanaim. What I'm talking about now are the graves of Babylonians who were brought from Babylonia to the land of Israel. The graves of the Tanaim, those graves are graves. And those are, as far as we know, these are the places that forever and ever have been treated as the actual graves of these people. So you have a whole bunch of them up there. And yeah. The one that you're referring to is Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's grave at Meron.
Yeah.
That's an old grave that's been revered in that area, and that's a traditional burial place of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Ezra was there last week, as a matter of fact. He was there Saturday night. I didn't know this. He explained to me that there is a festival. There was this last Saturday night at Meron, at the grave of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. And the reason for it is that last Saturday night and Sunday, the reason we had our Chelek Kedisha breakfast is that Saturday night and Sunday was Zayin Adar. It's the seventh day of Adar. Is the Yahrzeit of Moshe Rabbeinu. According to the Mekubalim, the Kabbalists, he explained to me, I didn't realize this, the Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai was considered to be an incarnation of Moses. And therefore, on Moses' Yahrzeit, they go to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's grave. Okay? So he said that last Saturday night, there were hundreds of people there. It wasn't like a Lag BaOmer. It was much more orderly than on the Lag BaOmer. Lag BaOmer was just madhouse. Ten thousand, 20,000 people are there in a relatively small place. Have you ever been there? Yeah, I was there just a few years ago. I went up to refresh my memory, and it's really quite small. I mean, smaller than Arzarua is, so it's an outside, but even the outside is just not that big. So to have 10,000 people there, it's tight. It's tight. Yes.
I don't understand what the benefit is of being buried in the land of Israel to somebody that's dead.
Because you may be dead, but you're not dead. Your soul is alive. Soul is alive. And life doesn't end with death. Death is simply a stopping place.
So what happens to the soul is different than if you're not buried in the mind?
The soul has to go through a purification, assuming that it's not already pure, which in most cases is correct. The soul is tarnished. The soul has sinned. Right? So the soul has to become purified some way or another. And one of the fast ways to do that is to put the body in contact with the land of Israel. That's the tradition. Admat Eretz Yisrael.
So the soul and the body are connected?
Somewhat connected, yes. Yeah, you could ask me the science of this, a little bit hard to describe.
Yeah.
But don't worry about that. I just spent yesterday, part of yesterday afternoon, reading about the impact of quantum physics on religious theology. And one of the things that it convinced me of is that problems like that aren't half as difficult as the basic issues that the physicists are dealing with in quantum physics. They've really come to the basic ideas of the universe, and this problem is easy compared to that. And they're perfectly happy to live with that, by the way. They live with the problems of quantum physics. They don't seem to be aware to solve those problems. As far as they can, there are ways to deal with them, but there's no way to solve them. And that's the same thing in religion.
Tehiyat HaMetim is only in the land of Israel?
Tehiyat HaMetim is... Well, no, it's not only
in the land of Israel.
Because let's say... Tehiyat HaMetim is a resurrection of the dead. Can't be only in the land of Israel, and it could be, but let's say you were buried in Queens, right out here, okay? Or I thought, let's say better than that. Where's our cemetery in New Jersey? Okay, you're buried in Jersey, New Jersey. Comes the Messiah, and all the action is going to be in the land of Israel. So you don't want to stay in Jersey. Nobody wants to stay in Jersey.
That's going to be long, right?
I mean, you could start out there, but you don't want to end up there. So the problem is, what do you do? I mean, you have to take a plane. You know, how do you get to the land of Israel? So the whole section on Masechet Sanhedrin, in the last chapter, that fancifully figures out how the bodies are going to get to the land of Israel. And basically, it's a system of tunnels. That seems to be the way that they expect to be. All kinds of these tunnels from New Jersey and everywhere else will get you to the land of Israel. The bottom line is that you can die elsewhere, you can be resurrected elsewhere, but you don't want to stay there because basically you're going to go to the land of Israel. So, yes, you can be resurrected elsewhere, but you're not going to stay where you're resurrected. All the Jews are going back to the land of Israel.
Why do you give reference to Hamzikin?
Because it's the closest to the Beit HaMikdash. Okay, it's not that you can't be resurrected elsewhere, but it's a location, location, location. All right? If you really want to be well located, you will be well located. You want to go through those tunnels from New Jersey to get to Yerushalayim?
You might think don't.
Right? It's awful. That's no way to live. The place to live is next door. Next door. So that's why the Jews... What? Mechilot, Mechilot. Kacha Tatuv. Mechilot, Mechilot.
No, is that Gilgul
Mechilot? I don't know. Gilgul Mechilot, I don't know. Probably it is. Mm-hmm. Although I'm not sure. The Mechilot, Mechilot is the way the Gemara says it. Mechilot, Mechilot. And if it's not the language that's used later, that's where it comes from. It comes from this idea of Mechilot in Tchiyat HaMitim. There are these tunnels. The ideal location is the Mount of Olives, Har HaZeitim. Because it's right next door. It's right next door. It's like living next to the shul. There's no better place to live. Okay. That's what I always say to people, by the way. As I say to you, when the resurrection comes, you're all invited because I'm only 3 minutes from the temple. You know where I am. I'm just 3 minutes from the temple, so you have to have a place to go to the bathroom. You need to get washed, a cold drink of water, anytime. Okay, so you should just know the invitation is out. Yes.
I'm a little concerned about this idea of the soul. It sounds like an indulgence that if you sprinkle some soil from Israel, then in the coffin or on the bier or whatever,
mm-hmm.
The soul is redeemed.
Well,
that's where in the world does that come from?
Torah.
Torah. I mean, that's like an indulgence to me.
No, I don't think it's an indulgence.
I think it is. And in redemption, these tunnels, the only thing that's going back to Israel is in medieval times, these were heavy rolling through tunnels back to Jerusalem.
Well, I'm thinking the art, medieval art, does pick up on some of these things. You will see some of this really actualized in medieval art.
Well, what
but
about
the indulgence, I don't think it's indulgence. I think there is no question that the land of Israel in the rabbinic literature, in the biblical literature, especially in rabbinic literature, has a power that is totally unique. You don't like it, you don't like it. But that's
what
the
about the people of the Holocaust or people that did not have soil of Israel? I mean,
yeah. So
if you sprinkle it on the graves
could you?
Poland or something like that, I mean,
I'm sure
weird.
Maybe. But somebody will probably do that sooner or later if they haven't done it yet. The land of Israel is unique.
And so that's an absolution.
The land of Israel is unique.
Your
land of Israel is unique. The land of Israel is unique. Do with it like what you like, but there's no question about it is totally different from every place else.
What land? What
Israel. And the land of Israel. The land of Israel. Okay? Yeah. It's an interesting thing. I can never figure. I don't really know the issues there. think it's different. They always told me when I was at, I used to go to Lubavitch in the old days to visit from time to time, and I sometimes went to hear the Rebbe, this was already many years ago, this was when I was in rabbinical school. So in those days, what they told us was that he felt that until the Mashiach came, you should be outside the land of Israel. At least the leadership should be outside of the land of Israel. That was the thought there. And when the Mashiach would come, that you would then go to the land of Israel. And the key thing that was involved, what they did, and they did this, let's see, I was a student, I was in Kfar Chabad in 1965. They had set up a town called Kfar Chabad outside of Tel Aviv, probably in 1959, 1960 or so. So it was relatively new. It was very poor. You felt like you were in the poor shtetl in Poland or the Ukraine. That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm going way back. Everything has changed. It must have been in the 1980s that they actually built in Kfar Chabad a complete reproduction of 770 Eastern Parkway. Mm-hmm. And I remember seeing for the first time riding along the road to Tel Aviv. So somebody said, you know, you got to make sure you take a look at that. So you actually ride along the road to Tel Aviv, you could get killed in the car because you look out there, it's exactly the same as Eastern Parkway. It's the weirdest thing in the world. They built it the same. And that was so that when the Rebbe would come, he would feel at home. He would feel at home. So, I mean, you get variations on these odd things. This is a variation. So a lot of other people. Yes.
So how many days would it take for them to bring the casket of a rabbi and Kabbalah to Eretz Yisrael? And is the fact that the body's not being buried immediately is the issue of Kabbalah made obviated by the fact that the purpose is to bring them to Eretz Yisrael?
I suppose that's true. So that's an interesting thought. I hadn't thought about that. And you're probably right. It was obvious that we're reading the story about them doing it, so they didn't have any magical way to do it. They just went, you know, as it would go. So they were located in the area around the Tigris River. So it must have been a fairly long trip. I guess they just did things like that. They couldn't have embalmed the body, or they would have said it if they had, I would think. This would be an unusual thing to do.
Ice.
Maybe died in the winter. I don't know. Okay, let's go on with this. All right. Askua lahatam. Now notice the language. Notice the language here. Ki askua lahatam. Both the words there are important. Askua is Aramaic for he'eluha. He'eluha. When they took him up. Because remember now, if you're living or you're dead, if you go to the land of Israel, it's always an aliyah. Always an aliyah. So even the Babylonian rabbi is dead, is going to the land of Israel, is askuha, he'eluhu. He'eluhu. Pardon? Histalkut. Well, maybe, but this is Aramaic. Maybe a revelation. Histalkut means, but the way we use it is actually that way. It's aliyah, aliyat ha-neshama. Ki askua lahatam. Now, hatam in Aramaic means sham in Hebrew. Sham, there. So when he went on aliyah to there, now you know where there is. From the Babylonian perspective, there always means the land of Israel. Okay, that's a code word for the land of Israel. Amu le-le-rabi ami le-rabi asi. They told Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Asi, Rav Huna Ate. Right? They said to him, these are two rabbis from the land of Israel. So they said to him, Rav Huna has come. Rav Huna has come. Right? Now, they are taking it at face value. They don't know that he died. So they think that he's come to visit. Ki hadinanatam, they then, as Israelis say, when we were there, meaning there is the opposite. There now means Babylonia. When we were there, lo havalan deluye reishen mine, we were unable to raise our heads mine from him, probably because of him. In other words, he was so much greater than we were that we will walk around like this. You know, he was really the great man there. And now we studied with him. Now we've come back to the land of Israel. Hashta atinanacha. Now we have come here to the land of Israel. Ata batrin. He's coming after us.
Oh, I thought they were big guys.
Yeah, exactly. So the English translation here actually has a sense of their resentment. That, you know, we couldn't come up to his shoulders there, so we moved far away. Now he's coming after us. What are we going to do? We're not going to be anybody anymore. Okay? It could be the meaning. Amru laho, then people said to them, to these rabbis, Aronoba, it is his casket that is coming. All right? No, not he. It's not he that he's coming. He's coming. He's dead. Aronoba. Rabbi Amiva, Rabbi Asinafuk. They then went out to walk with the coffin, which is the appropriate thing to do. They were his students, and they went out to walk with the coffin. Rabbi Ila, the Rabbi Hanina, lo nafuk. But these other two rabbis didn't go out. They didn't go out to greet and walk with the coffin. Okay. The Ika di Amre, there are those who say, Rabbi Ila nafak, that Rabbi Ilek went out. Rabbi Hanina lo nafak, but Rabbi Hanina didn't go out. Okay, then they did. Now the Gemara explains, the nafak, the one who went out, my tamei, what's the reason that he went out? The Tanya, because it is taught, arona over mi makom le makom, a coffin that passes from place to place, Omdim alav b'shura. When you finally get to the end of the place, you know, when you're going to bury the person, even at that stage of the game, omdim alav b'shura, you have, assuming the mourners are there, you stand in the line. Remember, there was a mourner's line after the burial itself. Okay, the mourners would line up. You're required to do even that. Okay. The only malav birkat avelim v'tanchume avelim, and they say upon him or upon it now, birkat avelim, the blessing of mourners, v'tanchume avelim. Now the blessing of mourners, you'll see, we'll see this in another few pages. We'll get to that. The blessing of mourners refers to what was a custom during the time of the Talmud, during the Birkat Hamazon. There was an insertion. If people were mourning, there was an insertion to include to bless the mourners. Okay? So that's the Birkat Avelim, the Tanchume Avelim. That's what we do. We still have that custom. That custom is HaMakom Yenachem Etchem B'Tov Sha'ar Avelei Tzion Yerushalayim. We have a phrase that we use, which is a phrase that is called the words of consolation. Right? And that's what you say when you're at the cemetery and people arrange themselves on, in a line and the mourners walk through you leaving the grave. You say to the mourners, HaMakom Yenachem Etchem B'Tov Sha'ar Avelei Tzion Yerushalayim. May God bring comfort to you among the mourners of Zion and Jerusalem. That's the formula that we have. Okay? It may not be that they had exactly the same formula, but it was something like that, and we have a formula that, that has that purpose. Okay, so what we have seen here in the Baraita is that the Baraita says that you're supposed to do that. If the bier moves from place to place, when it gets to the final resting place, once again, you have some of the customs which you might have had elsewhere. Okay? But now that we know that, how could it be that these guys didn't go out? I just read that some of them went out, some of them didn't go out. How could it be that they didn't go out? The Lona Fak, my Tama. If they didn't go out, what was the reason for that? The Tanya, as it is taught, another bright time. Arona Oveni Makom Makom. Coffin that passes from place to place. Ein omdim ala bashura. The opposite. You do not stand on that one in the line. The ein omdim ala birkat avelim. The tanchume avelim. And you don't say the bracha of the mourners, and you don't say the comforting words of the mourners. This is a problem. Here are two brachas. One bracha says you do say it. The other bracha says you don't say it. So the Gemara says, Kashina Hadade. Zemakshalze. One is contradicting the other. I said, what do you can't learn from these brachas then, because they're contradicting each other. But of course, the Gemara answers, La Kashya, this is not a problem. See why? Kan Shishildoka Yemet. In one case, in the first case, this is a case where the skeleton still exists. Okay? Where the skeleton is still intact. Kan B'she'en Shildoka Yemet. The second one is where the skeleton is no longer in it intact. All right? The Rav Huna Shildoka Yemet Abba. I'll go back to this in a moment, but if we had two different groups of rabbis doing two different things. Rav Huna had just died. It's obvious the skeleton must have been intact. So it couldn't be that this reason was the operative reason for these two different groups of rabbis doing two different things, all right? The Gemara then answers, the lama fak lo sayamu ha-kamehe. That group that didn't go out, after all, they didn't know when he had died. So they hadn't gotten the full report of the relevant facts, and so they assumed that this was what we would call a reinterment. In fact, to this day, these issues are relevant to reinterments. We have cases like this where you reinter a body. Luckily, for a variety of reasons, that bodies are reinterred, but they are. And interestingly, one of the reasons that is a justification, we don't like to usually do that. We usually prohibit it. So there's got to be a good reason to reinter a body. But one of the good reasons is burial in the land of Israel. Because if you bury somebody outside the land of Israel, and then you say, well, there's a reason to bury them in Israel, that's one of the reasons. But there are other reasons why it's also that. Frequently, I mean, the most common thing that we find is family reasons. They're family issues.
I have one little question. The last time we were talking about the Hebrew word, I don't know what it might have been, but it was a word for a bier or for a bed.
Mita.
And then now we're talking about a coffin, and I asked about a coffin the last time, and you weren't sure. Is the same word now being interpreted as coffin?
I'm not sure. No, it's a different word. You're right, there are two different words.
Oh, they're two different words.
They're two different words, correct.
Oh,
one is our own.
Changed now.
Yeah, one is our own and one is mita, but it's not clear whether both of them mean two different things or they both mean two different things. I just don't know the answer. Okay, we go on. We now learn more of Rav Huna's funeral. Amru, Hechaninche, where will we put him? Where will we put him? Now, the force of this, as you will see, is not exactly what cemetery will we bury him in, but rather, in the cemetery, where will he go? That's the force of it. Because look what it says. Hechaninche, where should we put him? Rav Huna ribeitz Torah b'Yisrael. Rav Huna spread the Torah throughout Israel. V'Rabbi Chiya ribeitz Torah b'Yisrael hava. And Rabbi Chiya also spread the Torah throughout Israel. Okay? The implication being, therefore, that he is a fitting neighbor. So if you're going to choose where to put Rav Huna, you put him next to Rabbi Chiya. You put him next to Rabbi Chiya. All right? So that solves one problem. But there's another problem. Man Ma'ile, who is going to bring him into the place? Who's going to bring him into the place? All right? And one of the rabbis steps forward. Amar laho Rav Chaga. Rav Chaga steps forward. Anam ailanale, I will bring him in. And you will see he is going to now prove his credentials. He's going with the rabbi into this crypt, as it were. He's going to bring him in there. Why is he worthy of that? The Okunte le Talmudai Giavina Bartamne Sreishnin. For I had already been established as a knowledgeable Talmudist by the time I was 18 years old. Okay. So in order to be worthy to accompany the rabbi, he says, I was already a knowledgeable Talmudist by the time I was 18. Not that. Not only that. Velo Chazi Li Keri. I had not had a seminal emission. In other words, his thoughts were so pure, as it were. Even though he was 18 years old, which is a dangerous time for such things, all right? Never would have occurred to him, because all he was thinking about was the Torah. Never thought about anything else. Okay? Umisham ale kameh. And I served him. All right? He also served God for me. V'yadi be'uvadei, and I knew his deeds. I knew the things that he did, such as, now he describes his inner knowledge about the rabbi. D'yom achad itapich alei ritzuad tefillin. I remember one day the strap on his tefillin turned over. When you put on a tefillin, you have to make sure that the black side of the strap is what's showing. Let's say the white side of this, the leather side is showing. It's no good. You have to have the right side of the strap up. Okay? Now, it's not something terrible, but it's not that perfect. You have to have the black side up. So, one day, Rav Huna had the wrong side of the strap up. V'yativ ala, and he wore it that way. And once he became aware of the fact, Yativ ale arba in tananita, he then fasted for 40 days. So in other words, he was such a tzaddik, Rav Huna. And who knew it? People didn't know these stories, except I knew it. I had done all these things. I was that close to him. Okay? So indeed, Rav Chaga gets the job. He gets the job.
Not being buried here with his family.
That's correct. I'm going to talk about what some of the implications are of what we're reading. And that's definitely true. Ilay, Rav Chaga brought Rav Huna in. Hava gane Yehuda nimine di avua. Yehuda, the older one of Rabbi Chiya's sons, was lying on his father's right side. The Chizkiya mismole. And the Chizkiya was on the left side. Got a third problem now. There's no room. We said that of all things, he's going to lie next to Rabbi Chiya. But they forgot that there is no next to Rabbi Chiya. Because Rabbi Chiya's sons died early, and they were buried there also. They were buried there. Ay. So this is now, listen to the story. Amar le Yehuda le Chizkiya. So Yehuda says to Chizkiya, these two dead sons. One says to the other. He says to him, the lav orach ara de kaim rav miduchte. Miduchtech. I'm losing my... Right. Kum miduchtech. Right. I'm sorry. Yehuda says to Chizkiya, kum miduchtech. Get up from your place. He tells his brother that. You get up. The lav orach ara dekayim Rav Huna. It's not nights that Rav Huna should be standing around.
That's wonderful. That's
what the thing.
Bahadi the Kain. Alright, so Yehuda tells his brother to get up. So the brother gets up. Bahadi the Kain. As Chisti is getting up, Kam Bahadi Amuda de Nura. Suddenly, a pillar of fire gets up with him. Of course, this is a great rabbi. The great rabbi has been lying there in the dust, and he rises in order to leave place for Rav Huna, but also, unanticipated, a ball of fire suddenly also comes up. Okay? Chaz ye Rav Chaga. The problem is, the dead can deal with this. Rav Chaga volunteered to go into the crypt. The poor guy, he didn't know what he was getting himself into. He goes into the crypt, and suddenly there's a fire in the crypt. All right. Chazye Rav Chaga. He sees this fire, this pillar of fire that's in the crypt. Ibayit, he was seized with terror. Scared to death. Zakfeh la'arone, he then takes Rav Huna's coffin and he puts it up between him, himself, and the fire to protect himself. Okay. V'nafak ata. Now, I think this means, this is the way it's interpreted here, and he went outside. All right? In other words, he ran for his life. Basically, he's such an honor, I'm going to take Rav Huna in, he gets Rav Huna in, he says, all right, goodbye, throws the Yaron in, and runs out.
He throws it in the fire.
Apparently. All right. V'hai d'la in ash anash, and the fact that he wasn't punished, namely that he got out of it alive, Mishum v'zatfeil aron ed Rav Huna. It's based on the fact that he was smart enough to raise up the coffin of Rav Huna to protect himself. The information that Mara tells you. Now, I would have thought, frankly, that it would have ended and said something like that. It was because of his piety. We already learned that he had studied Talmud. He never had a seminal mission. You know, we learned about our pious. Finally, the Gemara says the reason he survived all of this is because he was smart. In a dangerous situation, he did what you have to do.
But he also jeopardized.
You better believe it.
So why did that so smart?
Exactly. But apparently, he comes out, as far as the story goes, smart. That he saved his own life.
Where does
Zakaya
go?
Where does what? We don't know. We don't know. Amazing story. Wait. Hold it. Let's go a little further, and then we'll go back and we'll reflect on it. Almost the end of it.
Well, Zakaya is the source of all this, and he was the only one there.
I guess that's true. That's true. You're right. No, you're right.
Okay.
Now, remember Rav Chista. Rav Chista was the student also of Rav Huna. Rav Chista was the one who, after they had expected to put the Torah on the bier of Rav Huna, Rav Chista said, how can you do that? I remember that, you know, he wouldn't even sit with the Torah on his bed, so on. So now, Kinach Mavshei de Rav Chista, when the Rav Chista died, Savor la'otu vei sefer Torah apoye. They expected to put a sefer Torah on his bier. Amalaho Rabbi Yitzhak. Rabbi Yitzhak said to them, Milta de la Rabbi Losfirale. Something that Rav Chista's teacher, Rav Huna, did not think was correct. We know that Rav Chista told us himself that Rav Huna thought it was not correct. Anna Nekum Navile. We're going to do that for him? Not appropriate. Sava de lo mishlal kirayhu. Right? After Rav Chista's funeral, they showed their grief so much that they intended not to sew up the rend that they had made in the garment. Because for the sage, remember, they had made the rend in the garment. They made rends in the garment for the sage. So we read just briefly, if you remember, about basting up the rend. There was one that you don't sew up. Remember who that was for?
Yeah.
Parents, exactly. It's for the parents. So they wanted to show their grief that they weren't going to sew up the rend that they had made for Rav Chista. Okay? Amar lahu Rabbi Yitzchak bar Ami. Rabbi Yitzchak bar Ami says, Chacham, as far as a sage is concerned, Kevan shehechziru p'neihem me'acharei mita. Once they have turned away from the bier itself, Shalalin, you should sew up the rend. That's the story of Rav Huna and Rav Chista. Now let's go back to the story of Rav Huna. It's one of these very fanciful stories, and you could write an article, not so much, I mean, you could write an article on the story, but you could also write an article on the interpretations given of such a story. If you read the notes in the art school here, some of these notes are just ridiculous. They're ludicrous notes. Try to say, you know, how it all happens and how it all makes sense. I mean, this is just great literature. It's just fanciful types of storytelling, not out of line with the experience of students and teachers, and also that reflects a certain factual reality to it. And to me, it seems to me that what we are seeing here is, in all likelihood, burial in Bet Sha'arim. That's probably what we're talking about. We're talking about burial inside crypts, under the ground, in an area where, in fact, we know the rabbis were buried at that particular period of time. And I think that this is evidence, even though it's not direct evidence, it's indirect evidence, of sort of the stories, the tales that surround such a thing. Imagine, what you are doing when you bury in the crypt, it's quite spooky. I mean, if you've ever been into any of these crypts, go to the Roman catacombs. People tend to visit the catacombs, or go to a monastery. I was in a monastery once, I remember, up in Montreal. I was in a monastery in France. And you go into these places, and one of the things that you see are the bones of the monks, you know, and they're just all around. You know, there's an area, and the monks' bones live there, and they're in crypts. But basically, they're not hidden away; they're not buried in the ground. They just have a room where they stay. In the land of Israel, in certain underground formations, this was the way people were buried at that particular point in time. Exactly, they had shelves. Undoubtedly, you had some sort of natural geological structure, and then they carved out shelves, and people would be buried on the shelves. I think that what you're seeing here, if that's the reality, is kind of the fear of going into those places. It's a scary place to go into. You don't have electric lights. It's a spooky thing, to say the least. And it seems to me that that's sort of reflected behind the story. I must tell you that I had an experience somewhat like this. I don't think I've ever told any people at Ozaru about this, but I had an experience that was not this, but it was a very spooky experience. I was actually in the grave of my teacher, Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel. I was one of two people who were actually in the grave. When Heschel died, this was 1973, I believe it was. I was in faculty in the seminary. I had been ordained 2 years before, and was in the month of Tevet, Yud Chet Tevet. I remember the date of his Yahrzeit. So it was December, month of December. We had had a tremendous amount of rain. It had rained in New York just days and days and days and days. And Heschel had a brother. It's not close to his brother, but his brother was a Rebbe on the Lower East Side. And we were not even so aware of that. We were people who were his students. We sort of knew, but you know, didn't know at the same time. After Heschel died, his brother's Hasidim from the Lower East Side handled the burial. The burial was not handled by the seminary. I mean, the people from the seminary were there. In those days, there used to be a chapel. Some of you may remember this, on Central Park West and 79th Street. It was the West End Chapel. Do you remember that?
Columbus Avenue. That's where that goes.
Columbus Avenue, that's correct. Columbus Avenue and 79th Street, exactly. I stand corrected, you're absolutely right. Columbus and 79th Street, this is the West End Chapel. Then sold it, they tore it down and became an apartment building. And I guess in the 80s, when all those things were going on the West Side. So there was a chapel, and that's where Heschel's funeral was. It was in the West End Chapel. So the funeral was there. Massive crowd of people. It was not in the seminary. Just trying to think. Finkelstein was still alive. Finkelstein didn't like funerals in the seminary. And maybe for that reason, there were very few in those days. Much more in later days, but not in those days. And so we went then to the cemetery. He's buried in Queens. I don't remember which cemetery anymore. I think it's Mount Hebron. So these Hasidim were handling the burial. One of the things that they were careful about, as some of the Chevra Kadishas are, in the lowering of a casket into the ground, it can essentially be done two ways. The way we most commonly do it is that there is a mechanical device that does the lowering. There's a rectangular
frame.
Yeah. That has two, what would you call them?
Belts.
One toward each end. You lay the casket on it, and then they turn a button or something like that, and it's a friction mechanism that slowly lowers the thing down to the ground. You can vary the speed slightly, but it's a slow motion move to the ground. Many of the firmer groups will not use that device because they say nothing, everything should be done by hand. So this funeral is being handled by this group of Hasidim. Of course, they wouldn't use the device. Instead, two guys hold onto the belt at one end, two guys at the other end, and they lower the thing down. What happened was that because it had rained so much, the sides of the grave caved in. Coffin went tumbling, and the people who were holding it jumped back. They jumped back, and basically the coffin fell in. Fell over on its side, and the top became a jar.
Oh,
here you are, one of the great rabbis of the time. We're all standing there, and this has just happened. So everybody has said, well, what are we going to do? So two people, myself and a guy named Jacob Tashima. Have you ever heard the name Jacob Tashima? I'll tell you about him in a minute. Jacob Tashima is a Japanese graduate student who is a student of Heschel's. Tashima and I jump into the grave. So
I'm not quite sure. I'm envisioning that the
coffin is occupying the space. So what do you mean you jumped into the grave?
It was occupying a lot of the space, but we jumped onto the coffin and we put our feet around because we've got to get this thing properly straightened out. And there's no way to do it from up on top. We're dealing with a real problem. So Toshiba and I go into the grave. And he gets on one side, I get on the other side, and we fix the thing up. The top had fallen off. You couldn't see the body. It was not visible. But it was all it was all messed up. So we put the top back on. So we straighten everything out. You know, do what has to be done. And then they lift us out. You know, people would lean over, give us a hand. I come out and Tashima comes out. So it was a very spooky experience. You know, I that was the first and last time I was ever actually in a grave, and of all things, in Heschel's grave. I was actually in Heschel's grave. One of my claims to fame is fine. when I write about it someday, I'll tell you the inner story. The interesting thing that you should say that. Jacob Tashima, I actually tried to look him up recently, and I couldn't. I tried to use Google, and it didn't do any good. You could help me, Laura. Maybe you would know how to do this.
Back in Japan?
Tashima, as far as I know, I sat on his doctoral committee when he got his doctorate. So we gave him his doctorate. He then went back to Japan.
You send me
his father. But let me tell you, I'll tell you a little bit more. I'll tell you a little bit more. Hitler was the head of a group called, as I remember it, called the Makuya. The Makuya were these Philo-Jewish Japanese who had their own religious cult. And they believed that they had this guy who was Jacob's father, who was the head of the cult. And they believed that the Jews were the holy people, and then those who followed with the Jews too. And this is this small group of Japanese who followed. The Makuya sect. I think you're right. They used to go to Israel. They would go to Israel on a regular basis. They would always go to Israel. And they maintained very close relations with Israel, this Makuya. So Rabbi Wolf Kelman, I remember one time, he was a friend of Jacob Tashim. So he went to Japan because Tashim's father invited him to give a lecture to the Makuya. So he wasn't going to pass that up. So he went to the Makuya, and just to get back to your comment, Howard, he comes back, he tells us the story of giving a lecture. He says, first of all, the first thing that they do is that they have hot coals. And they walk across the hot coals. So he's waiting there. He says, they're all walking across. I got to give a lecture. And they're going to expect me to walk across that. I don't remember what happened, whether he walked across the hot coals or not. I remember him describing that they had to walk across. Yes, of course. That's how you do it. It's a thing that these Eastern religions do. They walk barefoot across hot coals. And the Indians do it, the Hindus do it, and the Makuya did it too. So that was about what Rabbi Kelman said. So Jacob went back after he got his degree to take over from his father the leadership of the Makuya. It was the last I ever heard of him. I know nothing about him. And I would be fascinated to know what became of them. Okay. That would be funny. That would be funny. So, this long story to tell you that it is a very spooky thing, even to be in a simple grave with lots of people around you, how much more so I can well understand the odd psychology of being in this place, of Rav Chaga, and what he had to go through.
You could look at the story also as maybe Rav Chaga should not have been so self-promoted.
Very good, very good, very nice. You're right. This is, in fact, he was punished. He wasn't punished by losing his life, but he was surely a self-promoter, and he should have had a little bit more modesty.
He had his first admission.
Could we just go back to the question of reburial?
Yes.
And what's the halakha if there is not exhumation, say, for forensic reasons?
Forensic reasons, you can do it. Exhumation for forensic reasons, that's normally a permissible reason to go into a grave. It's partly an issue of the state, and we, S for the state, but the state has certain rights, and we respect the rights of the state to prosecute or to learn what happens if there is reasonable cause to do such a thing. That's a reasonable cause.
So the same for autopsy, then?
Well, you try, yeah, the same is also true, correct, for autopsy. If there's reasonable cause, it's permissible to have autopsy. Nobody would tell you that, but because we're afraid to say that, because then they'll autopsy everybody. So we always say that autopsy is prohibited, except ask your rabbi. Okay, because instead of saying it's permissible, you know, ask your rabbi, say it's prohibited, ask your rabbi.
I will admit that I've missed the point of the story, aside from being interesting in the picture of the time, in terms of what it's supposed to teach us in terms of death and burial, what lessons.
I'm not sure that I could tell you the answer to that question. It's part of what you have in the Talmud from time to time is just rich stories, and to find moral meaning in them, that's one of the things, that's why I said the commentators are also as interesting as the story, because most of the commentators will try to get out of it what you would like to see in it. The commentators, just take a look here, take a look in the art scroll.
Thought I missed something bigger.
Let's see what we have here, just take a look.
40.
Where, which number?
Rashi is saying, infers that the merit of burying Rav Huna saves from punishment for disturbing the remains of
people. Let's go to 37, right? 37, I think, is the beginning of 37. Meiri interprets this allegorically as meaning that the sages decided that it was proper to disinter the body of Chizkiah to make room for Rav Huna. They are learning something very practical from this conversation between the two dead brothers. When I read that, I just think it's good literature. In good literature, you have two dead brothers talking to each other, and that's what makes a good story.
The question is, was it the older brother who told the younger brother, or the younger brother?
Well, that's what also what makes good literature. You don't say, and therefore somebody says, well, it must have been the older brother, somebody says it must have been the brother, must, you know. That's how a good story doesn't tell you all you want to know. Okay, it leaves out half of the things. Although a body is normally not disinterred to make room for another one, this was an unusual case due to the honor of the illustrious sage Rav Huna. Well, you know, just to read that out of it, sure, that's a moral in a way. It's telling you that for the greatest sage you can do certain things you wouldn't do in normal circumstance, and all of that is a way of praising the value of a great sage. And that's the moral of the story. I don't see that at all here. Similar incidents are recorded in Shabbos and so on. Next, this 38. This symbolizes that although the sages ordained the disinterment, they did so with extraordinary difficulty and in fear of being punished by the flames interred sages' merits. Well, that's possible. It could mean that. Pillar of fire accompanying a sage in death is a sign of unusual greatness.
Do we have other stories like this, or this is literally
so? I've never read another one like this. I mean, this is just a beautiful story. It's it's a story. If I were a writer also, this is the kind of story I'd work into my book. This wouldn't be my book, but I would have a story in the book, which would be the tensions of a great rabbinic family and of brothers and the way things are never finished in life. You know, real problems just plague you beyond the grave. I use this as sort of a background to get to that point.
In all those cemeteries, they're always talking about the male burial. Nobody was buried with his wife.
Right.
I mean,
right.
Yeah, that's interesting. We don't. I don't know that we know a lot about that. I don't know the answer to that question.
He was buried separately.
I don't know. I honestly don't know. You don't. For surely from this story, we don't know. I can't imagine that you had the type of the separate male-female type of separateness that we have today. I don't think that they had that in the time of the Talmud. There's no evidence of. So my sense is that you just get the stories about the men, that probably the women were probably buried next to their husbands, but I just don't have the evidence. I don't really know.
I was going to ask about this disinterment. For example, in Europe, or in Prague, or any of these small centers, the cemeteries were very small, and that was the only place that they could bury. I mean, this was a walled enclosure. And did they dig or disinter the bodies at certain times, for example, in the cathedral or in the monasteries that you're talking about?
I can't say.
They collected all the bones in the catacombs and stacked them.
All I can say is that in Jewish cemeteries, they buried people on top of each other. They still do that.
Yeah, but you couldn't go forever, could you? You have to go more dirt or something.
After a while, you can. I mean, if you go, for example, on the Mount of Olives, I was up in Mount of Olives before the Intifada started. I went up to visit the grave of Rav Kook on his outside. It was really wonderful. I was just so happy that he's buried there. And then just a little bit down is his son is buried there, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook. So I just was thinking to myself, you stand on the Mount of Olives in the middle of the cemetery, looking at Har HaBayit, you can see where the temple was, and it's just relatively few meters in front of you, and just it's overlooking it, so it's just, yeah, it's just so beautiful, it's just a gorgeous setting. And here, I was in the modern cemetery, but there's people in that cemetery since a little after the time of King David, you know, so you're dealing with 2,500 to 3,000 years of burials. Where did they go? there are certain ways that they must have been cemeteries. Well, I don't know. I don't know the reality. I think these things disappear after time. I think I don't know how long it takes, but they've been using these places again and again. As far as I know, they don't cart away bones. And I don't. Surely in my time, I never saw any discussion.
Well, they're
about
stored in the catacombs.
The catacombs, but they don't do that on the Mount of Olives, as far as I know. I've never heard of anything like that. Yeah, in Europe, they do that. Well, that's where the bones are buried separately. They're not on the ground. Okay. All right. With that delicious the peak and vineyard. This whole next section is filled with stories. We will get quickly. I said that we started with eulogies, and then we went to this odd story. We'll go back to the eulogies, and it's just one eulogy after another, some of which are good and some of which are terrible.
Do you have a Torah ready for tomorrow morning?
Do you have a Torah ready for tomorrow morning? I think the answer is yes.
Yeah.
I think the one on the far right was
right.
Red.
I
think that was red on the far other page.
Uh-huh. Okay. So,